49 degrees, winds up to 30 miles per hour later this afternoon. Right now the sun is shining. We got wind from the west at 14, currently 40 degrees. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Coming up on 8:11, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Jack and Drea, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the morning show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That sublime music is from a work called A Mass, and it is by Jocelyn Hagen. And she is one of the guests I have in the studio for part one of today's morning show here on WGTD. With her is Dr. Peter Dene, a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage College in the music department, who is the coordinator of the Christmas Festival at Carthage, a huge undertaking in and of itself. And this year's festival, which is this coming weekend, is titled From Heaven Above to Earth I Come. And Jocelyn Hagen, one of the country's most highly regarded composers of choral music and vocal music in particular, has been commissioned to compose a piece which the massed choirs of Carthage will be singing as the finale of this year's Christmas festival. So I'm so pleased to have the two of them with me in the studio for part one of today's program. In part two of today's program, we're going to be talking about a beautiful art exhibit, excerpts out of the St. John's Bible, which is currently on display in the art gallery at Carthage. And we'll be talking about that at the end of the hour. But in the meantime, Dr. Peter Dene and Jocelyn Hagen, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good that you can be here. Jocelyn Hagen, I love that music. I was just playing the Benedictus from this work, and I'm excited to talk with you about that and some of the other work that you have done. Dr. Dene, I'm glad that you're here. I want to mention in passing that this is already a challenging week, made more challenging when you had a little mishap while moving one of the grand pianos and broke a rib, so you are feeling a little uncomfortable. But despite that, everything's going okay as we lead into the festival.
Yes, we're moving in the right direction. We started rehearsals on full rehearsals on Sunday evening, rehearsing Jocelyn's piece. And then on Monday, more than just that, but the whole festival, running the festival. Tonight is our open dress rehearsal, and we're excited for it all to really begin tomorrow night.
Very good. And so then performances Friday night and Saturday night and Sunday afternoon. And unfortunately, as is almost always the case, all the tickets are gone.
Yes.
So we aren't having a conversation in terms of enticing people to come.
Right.
However, we probably should remind people that they can still experience the Christmas festival, even if they're not able to be there in person.
It is available live streamed. And I just found out yesterday it's going to be on the I don't know what it's called, in Kenosha, the cable broadcast Kenosha service.
So the public access channel. Okay.
Yes. But if you're looking for it online, you can just type into Google Carthage and live stream, and it'll give you the website that you need.
And they do a beautiful job, I must say, in terms of the usage of multiple cameras that really give you all kinds of different angles, and you really have a sense that you are there.
Improving it every year. We've got a new this year we worked a little bit more on the audio side. Last year the video had really jumped up a lot, and so we tried to match that this year with the audio that we're producing.
Fantastic. So I know one of the things that excites you most is this commissioned work.
Sure.
Tell us a little bit about what is behind this commission, because I don't think it's been a common occurrence at all for Christmas Festival for this to be part of the proceedings.
No, so this year is this entire year has been a celebration at Carthage and lots of Lutheran places all over the world. The 500th anniversary of Martin Luther making his declarations of where he thought faith should be and what needed to happen. If you come to the festival, if you can even get the program online, I have a really great synopsis of all of that on the inside cover. But for Carthage, this is actually the culminating event of this year of celebration, and so I wanted to commission a work that was part of it, and I have to say that a community member here in Kenosha, Mary Dixon, who's been a longtime supporter just by bringing lots of friends to our festival, is the person who has funded this. So I'm very grateful to her. So I told her my vision, and then she said, before I could even get it all out, she said, what do you need? And so that was really cool. And then I contacted Jocelyn. I've done several pieces by Jocelyn before, and I also just follow her, what she's writing for other people, and just knew it would be the right thing to do. Contacted her, she was on board, and then I had done another composition premiere with Abby Batinas, and she had had commissioned or asked Michael Dennis Brown to write the poem that she composed that piece to, and Michael Dennis Brown has written for many choral works. He's very good at kind of writing lyrics that fit well with music. And so I commissioned him to write the lyrics. And the kind of the bounds that I gave both Jocelyn and Michael were that this was happening because of this 500th anniversary, and that I had chosen this carol that Martin Luther had written, From Heaven Above to Earth I Come. And actually, our title is slightly changed from the one you introduced, because my conversation with Michaels, I said, I want your poem to be something that moves the ideas that Martin Luther had into the 21st century and speaks to our students. And he changed it to From Heaven Above to Earth You Come. So that's the title of our Christmas festival.
Ah, I've forgotten that. Yeah. And now that you say it, now I remember.
and so it was this beautiful text that is all about, you know, what life, what Earth was like before Jesus came, and the culminating part of Jocelyn's has this, we once were shadow, now we shine, which is just beautiful.
Mm. It is a gorgeous piece, and it's exciting to have you here. And Jocelyn Hagen, first of all, has music always been a part of your life? I mean, central to it from the cradle?
Yeah, pretty much. my mom was a piano teacher and then later a professor of music education in Valley City, North Dakota. But really, my first musical training was listening to her and her two sisters sing in harmony. Hmm. They were wonderful as a group, three women singing. They used to do commercials on the radio and things like that.
Wow.
So they're just wonderful, and that was part of our tradition. Every time we get together, there's always a lot of singing involved. We get out our instruments, and yeah, so that was really my first musical training was in that.
Hmm.
Yeah.
But you were saying that you are actually, in terms of your background, primarily a pianist rather than a singer.
Yeah.
So when did piano enter the picture?
I started playing when I was three. So it, I thought about becoming a piano performance major for a while, but I've kind of always known that writing is what I really wanted to do, and never really thought, you know, I'm from North Dakota originally, and you know, North Dakota, there aren't really any composers. So I never knew any, didn't really think of it as an option. And then, but I knew it was what I always wanted to do. So, it just took me a while to get there.
Right.
Yeah.
When did you actually first start actually exploring that possibility? I mean, when did you start writing music, under what circumstances?
I was a senior. Well, let's see. I can go back a little further, because I started off as a singer-songwriter. I had a band. We were the Stolen Suitcases. and we played around town and did things. And but then it was when I was a senior in high school that I wrote one piece in collaboration with another musician, my bandmate. And then I also wrote a piece for women's choir and piano called Evening Star, with text by Edgar Allan Poe. And I wrote it for a competition. I was taking theory at the college from my mom. And so, in theory, you start to write, you know, compose little things. And then this competition came up, and I was like, oh, I think I'm going to try and write something. And turned out I was ineligible for the competition in the end. But I did come out with a piece, and my high school choir performed it for the baccalaureate ceremony, and I was hooked.
Wow.
Yeah, I was just, I need to do this.
Yeah, the joy of just hearing musicians do your, and besides your own band, which isn't quite the same thing when you're part of the band.
Right,
To hear others do your music. What sort of a leap did it feel like to shift from writing, I assume were fairly contemporary songs for your band, to writing something for a choir? Did it feel like an entirely different kind of endeavor?
That's a really great question. And no, I don't think it did. It all just feels creative and natural. I mean, there are some choral pieces that I've written where my singer-songwriter side actually really comes into the process. Like, years ago, I was commissioned to write a piece for my high school choir for their Pops concert, which was a big thing in Valley City. And I wanted to write a piece that really fit in with that, but that could also be performed at their spring concert. So I wrote this piece called On My Dreams, and it has a very poppy kind of piano accompaniment. And I did write it by how I used to write songs, by sitting down and, you know, coming up with a groove on the piano and singing over the top. And that's how that choral piece came to be. But yeah, it definitely feels like a song, you know, in that way too.
Hmm. What did it feel like when you started to really study composition? For instance, I assume in your time at St. Olaf, where mm-hmm. you graduated, that you studied composition there. Yes. What did that feel like, given the fact that you'd already been a composer? Did it feel like kind of a strange intrusion to have somebody suddenly sort of telling you how to do this? or was that okay? Did you welcome that?
Yeah, no, I really loved it. I had a really great first composition teacher. His name was Peter Hamlin. His name is Peter Hamlin, he lives on the East Coast now, no longer at St. Olaf, but he was so encouraging always, you know, just try this, yeah. And it was always more like, well, what if you tried this or this? And I was like, oh, okay. You know, it was more steering. Teaching composition is a tricky mm-hmm. thing because, you know, one of the hardest things about becoming a composer is finding your voice. And so... And I do teach a little bit of composition now at North Dakota State University. And so it's always something I'm thinking of is, you know, how do you bring this voice out of that person? So you're teaching a lot of skills, a lot of, you know, instrumentation and showing what other people have done and or this is how I have done it. But, you know, they have to find it themselves. And it's not an easy journey.
Right. I don't think so either. And I think one of the tricks with many young composers, I know this is sort of the way I sort of felt like it. I'm not sure if you did, but I always sort of began with this presumption that everything that flowed out of my pen was wonderful because it flowed out of my pen. And it was really pretty jarring to suddenly have somebody sort of, in a sense, coldly and objectively appraising it.
Yeah.
In a way that, at least in the early days, I never did. Uh-huh. So I think that can really be a very tough experience for a young composer and for a young writer, for instance, mm-hmm. who loves to write poems. And then suddenly there's this crabby teacher saying that these poems aren't as great as we thought they were. But it doesn't sound like you experienced very much of that.
Oh, I definitely had some of that. Some teachers, especially in graduate school, who didn't really jive with what I was doing. Didn't see a lot of the value in it. So that was hard for me. Really, my graduate school training taught me to stand up for myself and for my music. Mm. I've had a lot, and I think part of it, too, is that I always have been very close to the performers of my music. You know, I've learned a lot from the conductors and the people actually, you know, getting their hands dirty in the piece and figuring it out, and learned so much more that way. Yeah.
For those of you just joining us, I'm happy to be speaking with composer Jocelyn Hagen, who has been commissioned by Carthage to write a piece that the combined choirs of Carthage will be singing for this weekend's Christmas festival. Dr. Peter Dene, the coordinator of the festival, is in the studio with us as well. So typically, what is your process, for instance, when you receive an invitation from a place like Carthage to compose a brand new piece? Typically, how do you get from A to B?
Yeah. Well, a lot of times the hardest part with writing a piece of vocal music is figuring out what the text is going to be. And in this case, I was really happy because I had never worked with Michael Dennis Brown before and, of course, known his work and admired it for years. So I was really excited to see what he was going to give me. It's also scary working with a commissioned poem because you never know what it's going to be in the end. I mean, I could have read it and hated it, but I'm so glad that I didn't. but I, you know, I'm glad you brought up that line. We once were shadow, now we shine, because that was really the influence for a lot of the sound of the work, was this idea of shining. And so, and also Peter told me that I could write it for piano, but also I could use percussion if I wanted to. So it seemed right to pick all these metallic, percussive sounds that would shine, you know, with the choir. And that was really fun. And I'd never written for that kind of ensemble before with choir. So I was really excited to dive into that.
Mm-hmm. When you are composing, is it a somewhat tortured process? Is your waistbasket full of sort of misfires and missteps or... or are you more of a Mozart and it just sort of appears as if by magic, or is there some place in between?
You know, every piece is its own little creature, and it is. I'm also a mom. I have two boys, and every piece of music also feels like a birth in some way. You're creating this little thing that goes out into the world. I mean, you have to set it free and let it become what it's going to be. And sometimes the process of getting it out into the world is a tricky one, is a tough one. This one actually was a little tricky. Normally, I don't have a. There's no norm, you know, every piece is so different. But this one was tricky, and it had nothing to do with the musical material it was the fact that I just, my living space was being encroached. I'm also in the process of moving. And it takes a lot of brain space for a piece to come out. And I just was not getting all of that time and attention that I usually get to make a piece of music like that. So I was all excited. I was thinking I was going to turn the piece in early, and I ended up turning it on the day the day it was due, because it just I had to ask my family to leave me alone. and it was a little bit painful, this one coming out, but you never know how it's going to be. Some require a lot of labor, and then others come out, like that Benedictus. I think I wrote that in about a week, and I wrote the majority of it in a day.
Wow.
You know, just because the idea was there, and it's based on basically one singular idea or ostinato. Most of it just was there. And I'll never forget that. There are many, many pieces where I can remember exactly where I was and what it felt like when I was writing it, and I'll never forget Benedictus, because I was working as an accompanist for a high school, and so in between classes I would have, you know, 15-20 minutes to sit in a practice room and write, and that's when that came out, was in between two classes.
Very good. So not even in the most glamorous of circumstances, but a sublime piece of music emerges. So can I ask what kind of a time frame we're talking about for the creation of this work that's going to be sung at Carthage's? I mean, are we talking about months, years, decades? I mean, how long have you been at work on this?
I think the writing time, like once I actually start, once I had the text and was and had gone through it, and, you know, probably about a month, 4 weeks of pretty serious, concentrated writing time. That's how much I like to devote to a piece like this. I don't always get it, but yeah.
How do you think about the matter of difficulty? Not just with this particular piece, but with anything that you write, in terms of whether or not this is a piece that the singers for whom you're writing are going to be capable of singing it well.
Yeah. Oh, it's something I definitely think about a lot. And as a younger composer, it wasn't on my mind as much. I was singing in the Singers, which is a professional choir in Minneapolis. And that's the group that commissioned and premiered a mass.
Oh.
And so I'd been singing with that group for years. I knew exactly what we were capable of and how much I could stretch them. And so that was really fun. It was a real playground in terms of composition. I could do so many different things and really stretch them apart. But that is not the norm, and like with this piece, I wanted it to be so that a lot of different people could perform it, could enjoy it and do it. And so, you know, things like it's for piano and optional percussion. Of course, the percussion really makes it extra special, but you can do it without it. I really wanted to have a melody that was very singable. So it doesn't have a huge range. It feels pretty natural within the voice. I think about all those things and weigh them appropriately. Because I realized, you know, a mass is one of my creations I'm most proud of, but it's only been performed in its entirety twice because it is so hard. And I think it's going to be performed again next year, which I'm super excited about, as well as be recorded. I wish that more people could do it, but I know it's my fault because it's so hard. So yeah, and I realized that, you know, I could be writing all this incredible music, but it's nothing if people aren't doing it, if people aren't performing it, if it's not living through performance and reaching audiences, then it's just for me, and I don't want it to be just for me.
So. Right. You don't want it sitting on the shelf.
No, I don't.
It came up in passing that you are good friends with another composer who has some pretty strong Carthage ties and ties with Dr. Dinet, Abby Batinas. And it makes me wonder, what kind of community are we talking about in terms of you and other composers, and what kind of difference do you tend to make in each other's lives and careers?
Oh, it's huge. I think that's a main reason for my success. Abby was a year older than me in school at St. Olaf. So we were there together, but we didn't really know each other all that well. But I remember going to her senior composition recital, and it had never been so packed. It was amazing. She's a huge inspiration to me. I was like, if Abby can do this, so can I. And what's really funny is we have exactly the same training. I just kind of followed her around. We both were at St. Olaf. Then we got our master's at the University of Minnesota, and then also studied in Paris at the European American Musical Alliance, a program that is in the style of Nadia Boulanger. Mm. And we also lived together after college. So that was when I really got to know Abby, and she introduced me to my husband. And so I owe Abby the world, you know. But she was also an assistant for Libby Larson. Uh-huh. And she was learning all about, you know, how to actually make it work as a composer. What do you need to be able to do? And she shared all that information with me. And we kind of figured this out together, how to make a living as a composer, how to actually make it happen. And also Stephen Paulus was a mentor of mine in the cities. And when we decided to create a publishing company, you know, we took Stephen Paulus out to lunch and said, okay, are we crazy? Should we do this? And he was so generous and really helped us with how that came to be as well.
I was reading about one of the most exciting collaborations in your career, which involved a piece called Controlled Burn that I believe was written for the public schools of Minneapolis. Just say a quick word about this collaboration and what it says about you as a composer and what is most important to you.
Yeah, well, it was a real thrill to get that call for this commission. Unfortunately, it was all tied in. You know, it was actually meant for Stephen Paulus, that commission. And after his stroke, I got this phone call that said, we need this piece. It's a collaboration with Dessa, and it's a short timeline. Can you do it? And of course, I jumped at the opportunity. But I'll always think of that. It's a very bittersweet memory thinking of that. But I was really thrilled to have the opportunity to work with Dessa because I had been a fan for years. I don't know if you know her work, but if you don't, you should. In fact, if you know Hamilton, Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton, he said that one of her pieces, I think it was Dixon's Girl, was one of his inspirations for Hamilton, which is a huge deal.
Oh, yeah.
And so he also invited her to be on his mixtape. So she does a song, I think it's called Congratulations, on that mixtape album. So if you haven't heard her yet, you can go there to hear it. But she's got lots of other great stuff. And so I was really excited about this opportunity to collaborate with her. It's always kind of scary collaborating as a composer, especially for me as an only child who definitely appreciates the solitary aspect of what I do. But lately, that has really been blown wide open, and I've been collaborating a lot more with many other kinds of artists, and it's been very satisfying. But she was one of my first collaborators in terms of creating a piece together. And I was really excited to see how she would approach it. She very much wanted to be part of the musical process as well. She didn't want to just write the lyrics. She wanted to help with the melody. She wanted to help come up with the material that supported the melody. And it was so cute. So we would meet at this church because it was close to my house and I had a key. And she would play the piano, you know, and just, you know, she's like, I don't really play, but I have this idea. And it was great. And I was like, oh, yeah, we can definitely make that work. What surprised me is that, you know, as a composer, I almost always, you know, 98% of the time have the text right there in front of me. So I know what it's going to be from start to finish and craft my piece from there. But what surprised me is that she would start singing and she didn't have the words filled in yet. She's like, the melody's going to go like this and I don't know what I'm going to say yet. And I was like, wow. So it all, you know, that was very messy in terms of how that all came together, which I thought was really fascinating. But yeah, so that was a piece for choir and orchestra. And then later I did a version for chamber ensemble. And I think now I've just been, I'm going to make a version for SSAA choir and chamber ensemble. But yeah, it's a great piece. The text is really, really incredible because she wanted to focus, because it was written for high school students and she didn't want it to be pedantic or, you know, like a We Are the World kind of, you know, just this like glossy kind of image of what it means to be in high school and to be growing up. She wanted it to feel gritty and real, and the text definitely does that. Mm. Yeah, we're born with a fuse timed to ignite.
Oh,
it's
great.
And in controlled burn. I mean, it's a great image. It's a great, so it's a neat piece.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Well, so is the piece you've written for the choirs of Carthage, which will serve as a very, very exciting high point in this weekend's Christmas festival. In just the last minute or so, how often do you get to be on the scene to hear a piece in its final rehearsal and its first performance? I imagine that is an especially great pleasure.
It is, yeah, watching it come to life. Because, you know, up until now, it has only been in my head. So it's wonderful hearing actual voices do it. I still make it to most of my rehearsals before a premiere, but it's getting harder. Mm-hmm. My schedule is getting just busy, and it's wonderful. And also, I have to keep in mind that if I travel all the time, I can't sit home and write, which is what I really need to do too. So, it's like everything; it's balance.
Right. Well, it's a nice problem to have when you have so many commissions and so many places where your music's being done, and it's being done at Carthage College as part of this weekend's Christmas festival. Jocelyn Hagen, it's absolutely a delight to meet you, and I'm so glad that you can be on hand for the world premiere of your piece this weekend at Christmas Festival. And Dr. Dene, remind our listeners, if they want to experience the Christmas Festival via the live stream, what they should do.
Okay, so it's Friday and Saturday at 7:30. The live stream will start at least a half an hour before that, with some videos and things. And so you can go to Google and just type Carthage live stream and you'll find it there. On Sunday, the concert starts at 4. One quick thing to add, it will just take a second. On Saturday at 1:30 in the Campbell Student Union, Michael Dennis Brown will be reading some selections from his most recently published book, Chimes.
Fantastic.
So you're welcome, and that's open to the public as well.
How wonderful that he will be on hand as well. Yeah. Very good. Dr. Peter Dene and Jocelyn Hagen, thank you so much for making time in your schedule to be part of the morning show today. This was a pleasure and honor.
Thank you.
Here's just a little bit more of A Mass. This is the Gloria. Music of Jocelyn Hagen from her piece called A Mass. It's 8:44 here on WGTD, and for part two of today's program, I want to play for you a portion of a conversation I recorded yesterday with Ryan Peter Miller, who is Assistant Professor of Art and Director of the H.F. Johnson Art Gallery at Carthage. The exhibit that is on display right now is absolutely gorgeous. It is excerpts, if you will, from the beautiful St. John's Bible. And so here's a portion of the conversation that we recorded yesterday in the art gallery.
The process of putting this together was a very long process. It was like 1998 that Donald Jackson, who is the primary artist and calligrapher for this particular Bible, went to the St. John's Abbey and said, this is a thing that I've always wanted to do. You know, he had made it known that he had wanted to produce his own Bible from start to finish from a pretty young age. And so they worked and created a kind of a plan. They actually worked with a committee to kind of decide what the vision of this Bible was going to look like. Ultimately, there were six calligraphers that worked with him, and you can see, or you know, I think a trained eye can potentially see that there are some variations within the way that the text has been drawn or written, however you want to kind of perceive that. I see it as a form of drawing mostly. Mm. But he oversaw all of that, and he designed the specific type of calligraphy that was to be used throughout. Hmm. So it's a specially designed font, one that he wanted to be readable and accessible, that both kind of honored the tradition of calligraphy, but felt a little bit more contemporary as well. Hmm. And then artists separately, he worked with a number of artists. And in my research, I couldn't actually find the exact number. But if you go on the website, you can see a list of many of them, perhaps all of them. But everything was very carefully curated by him and ultimately a committee of people within the Abbey and the university that really kind of had a desire to help him craft this in a particular way to make it hopefully most successful. Mm.
So this is from St. John's University up in Collegeville, Minnesota.
Yes.
Why don't you pick out a couple of pieces that you think are maybe especially noteworthy as far as you're concerned, or that you hope people would make a point of seeking out when they
sure.
come
so
and look
we,
at this?
We can come over, we can look at I think some of these pieces that are like less with text and more with just image are the ones that I'm specifically drawn to. Hmm. And I'm using the double entendre there. I think what's most compelling about the way that the illustrations, the drawings have been depicted here is that they're not explicitly contemporary, they're not explicitly historical, but there's a combination of things that are happening. So there's some abstractions, there's some simplifications, some very modest line work, and then that is coupled with some very vibrant colors and kind of this visualization of kind of like 5th century type Byzantine egg tempera style painting. So we're standing in front of one that's called The Life of Paul, and we're seeing a depiction of Paul as he's standing kind of on a body of water. There is text embedded in it as well, so
although it's interesting, you really have to look closely to even see it, and even closer to be able to read it, or at least some of it.
Right, and part of that, which may not be immediately obvious, so it's called an illuminated Bible, and the thing that makes it an illuminated Bible, or things that makes anything an illuminated text, is that it also has some gold leaf or silver leaf or platinum leaf, some kind of reflective surface. And what we actually have, what we've been given by the press, are something called Shigley prints. And that is a pretty contemporary term that maybe sounds a little fancier than it actually is. These are actually inkjet prints. So when we're seeing them, you'll notice things that look, you know, like they have these kind of big jumps from white to yellow to kind of like these dark umber colors. And these are areas that would typically, in the actual original piece, be represented with some kind of foil, which is a gold leaf that has been applied to the surface. But because it's a print and it doesn't have that embellishment there, like specifically at the top here we're reading, I saw a light from heaven, like it has the maybe illusion that it's reflective, but it's not. But on the original piece, it would have been.
Interesting.
The pieces were made, maybe we can walk over here and talk. The pieces were made originally on calf skin, so they're stretched to 2 feet by 3 feet. And then there's a process of soaking them in lime and then kind of stretching them and even shaving them down. It's called calfskin vellum, and so it's a very smooth surface, and then on the back side of it, it would be a little bit coarser. The materials that they use are they use quill pens, and the ink is like a Japanese block ink, which is made from soot and usually some kind of animal glue. And so then that gets kind of reactivated. It's a dry kind of condensed block, and then it gets kind of shaved and reactivated with water. The color that you're seeing is egg tempera, so it's like one of the oldest forms of painting that has stuck around, and it's a very opaque and pretty viscous paint material. I'm actually teaching a class in which we're using some egg tempera right now. So there's some really vibrant colors, and it's one of the oldest paints that's been around, and it maintains its vibrancy. And we can see it in the reproductions here, but I would imagine with the real ones that it's even more intense. What we're missing in this experience is kind of the tactile surface that would produce, which will probably have some thickness and some body to it. Additionally, like I said, there's some leafing that's going on. So we're standing in front of some Gospel of Luke section here about the birth of Christ. And we can tie that back in a minute for why the show is actually here and kind of the correlation of events on campus. But, you know, you can see there would be a lot of gold leaf here. And the way that that's applied is there's a gesso surface, and gesso is like a calcium, like a white chalky surface that is mixed, again, with an animal glue. And from what I read specifically for this process, the artist would blow through like a bamboo tube and just kind of reactivate the glue with just the slightest warm, moist air. And then you lay down the gold leaf or silver or platinum leaf on top and then kind of move it away with a burnisher or a brush. And so then it's applied. And so when looking at this one, you can see through the middle, there would be like this big kind of golden shaft of light. And it still registers as light here, but it would be like really reflective, I think, on the original one. There's some other things that they've done, which you might be able to see. Certainly there's an embellished stamp at the bottom of every page, which connects, but they actually use stamps like rubber stamps or applique things that create themes throughout the entire publication. So you'll see repetitive forms, if you look carefully, that shows up in multiple pages, perhaps. And this is here because last year we celebrated the Luther 500, which was the 500th anniversary of Luther posting his proclamations for reform of the church. And so this was a decision that was made a couple years ago, knowing that we could bring this to have that kind of in coordination with that event.
And because now this weekend is Christmas festival, people who come to that can also swing by the art gallery right next door and take all of this in.
Right. And so our opening reception is tomorrow, which is 4:30 to 7:30 in the gallery. Serve some refreshments. But we're also going to have extended hours while the Christmas festival is going on. So we'll be open while people are here kind of getting ready to go in, or when they come out, we'll still be open. So they'll have an opportunity to see. And one of the things that we did in coordination was Friday from 4 to 7, we will also be doing a letterpress demonstration. So one of our faculty members, Lisa Bogulky, is a master printmaker, and she will be demonstrating the letterpress, which is, of course, partially what helped the Reformation to happen. It was the tool that kind of helped to create the materials that got spread, that perpetuated these ideas from Martin Luther. And so guests will be invited to come and kind of watch that and participate in that, and you can actually take home an individually crafted letterpress from here on campus.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a great
idea. So that's Friday.
Absolutely. Fantastic. So these, what we're seeing, these beautiful pieces of artwork are hanging in frames on the wall, but of course, they weren't created for that in a sense, although
right.
I suppose there was the expectation that some of this would be displayed in this fashion. So there is a book, a Bible in which all of this can be seen.
Right. Yeah, so the actual original pages are like 2 feet by 3 feet, so they're enormous. And they're working, from what I understand, in creating, or they're already created, versions of these books that you could actually purchase, and they are to scale, and they will be embellished, but they won't be individually handcrafted, but there will be some embellishments, like go back and have gold or silver leaf kind of put back into them. But it's 1,165 pages, seven actual editions, and those you can purchase those books, so they're, you know, like you could essentially step into them. But what they've sent us are a smaller version. So in another way, it's kind of interesting. Like as much detail as is within each of these prints, we're seeing kind of less of that because they're significantly smaller than what was originally produced.
The very, very first thing would have been even bigger than what we're seeing.
Exactly. Yeah.
And I think one of the things I also like about this is seeing them on a wall hanging in frames, in a sense, underscores the fact that it was artists who created these.
Right.
That they didn't appear by magic and not through some computer program, but
right.
These are actual works of art by artists.
Yeah, and you bring up the computer. So the layout of the book actually was originally made, like, you know, just the structure of it, like where the page breaks would happen and where the images would happen, you know, full page images versus images with text, or things like marginalia, or like small images that are kind of decorating the sides of the text pieces. So it was laid out, you know, kind of in the contemporary way that books are laid out. But it kind of did go back to this more like old-fashioned, traditional, historical way of producing the book. And it's just page by page, individual pages. And it was overseen, like I said, there was like 6, I think, calligraphers. And so that was overseen to make sure that as they're writing that, like, you know, like it's all handwritten, so you have to make sure that it actually fits in the space as you planned very carefully. You know, there's the potential for it to spill over into the next page, so there's a lot of very careful craftsmanship that makes sure that it doesn't.
Well, it's gorgeous, and we hope a lot of people will seek out the opportunity to see this. If you are coming already for the Christmas Festival this weekend, it's a perfect opportunity to see this. Otherwise, what are the hours for the gallery for people to come see this otherwise during the course of a normal week?
Noon to 5 is the with some during the weekdays, with some extra hours up till, I believe it's 8 o'clock on Thursdays. Is that right, Jessica? 8 o'clock. I got that right.
Very good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, this is something not to be missed. And how long is it on display here?
It'll be through the middle of December.
So people should not delay if they want to see this for themselves.
Yes.
Very good. Ryan Peter Miller, the director of the art gallery here and assistant professor of art, thank you for taking the time to walk me through this beautiful exhibit.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Again, this lovely exhibit is currently on display in the H.F. Johnson Art Gallery, and it really is gorgeous. This is one of those moments when I regret that we're talking on the radio and we can't share images, all 25 prints from the St. John's Bible. And so I hope you will take advantage of that opportunity. Tomorrow on the morning show, Nalloway Rooks author of an intriguing book called Cutting School, Privatization, Segregation, and the End of Public Education. The book is a look at how public education, particularly in the poorer parts of our country, is under siege from several different directions. And the well-being of many of our public schools